Okay, I'm on the line with, or the resonant interval, the electric resonant interval, with Cameron McCune once again, and we're continuing to find out what the heck I meant in my recent long essay or book, in quotes. And we're looking at the preface page where I say the following: I'm making a Marshall McLuhan kit of quotations nobody knows about. Quotations nobody knows about. To get out of this cul-de-sac of 50 stuff that they repeat ad nauseum, meaning McLuhan scholars and McLuhan fans. Have four examples: the medium is the message, the global village, media ecology, and the tetrad. I consider them undergraduate McLuhanism, and it's time to get and move into postgraduate school, so to speak. And of course, Cameron has made a lot out of the cul-de-sac phenomenon, he's informed me. So we'll let Cameron say some things about a cul-de-sac that we probably haven't heard of before in relation to McLuhan. Okay, you got something?
Yes. I think it's distinctive of how I try to read McLuhan that I don't avoid very deep questions. What I do is I say it's deep questions that give the introduction to McLuhan. So instead of avoiding something like infinite regress, once the topic of media is brought up, right? If everything we say is shaped by media, then everything that we say about media is shaped by media. And everything we say about media is shaped by media. So you get an infinite regress. And the question is how McLuhan either stops the infinite regress or doesn't get involved in it somehow. It's a deep question that implicates postmodernism, that implicates a lot of classical philosophy. And so I think questions like this are very important for McLuhan, and strangely enough or tragically enough, they're nearly always avoided. And so that ties in with what you were just saying about undergraduate and graduate approaches to the man.
Yes, definitely. I thought the cliches, the medium is the message, global village, media ecology, and the tetrad, were not useful anymore. They didn't attract any, say, a younger mind's attention. It just sounded old. And and knowing McLuhan was working deeper, as you were just explaining, it was like I'm saying, we got to start over again. You could say the McLuhan industry, as usual, causes a huge disservice, and the effort of process, you know, process pattern recognition McLuhan was into in depth is lost.
That's right. And that's the when you said that it has to start again, that in itself is a very interesting problem.
Yes.
Because starting again is a very difficult concept because we've always already started. And so in our having already started, how do we start again? And so that comes to implicate tactility, the gap, right? There has to be a kind of backward somersault out of one type of thinking into another, and that's closely related to the cul-de-sac.
Yes. Okay, so what do you think the backflip entails? Is there somebody or something you discovered in your studies of McLuhan that provided the backflip for you? Backflip.
How does that work? Well, I think once you begin to think in terms of all at onceness or synchronicity, then the idea of a backflip becomes at once difficult and enlightening, because something like a backflip must always already be taking place, right? So when McLuhan loves words like retrieval, recognition, all of the replay, he loves all of these re-words because there's a kind of clutch in experience that is always there and can't be avoided. So the thing that people are trying to find is already there. And I have a quotation in one of my essays from Al-Ghazali, the Arab philosopher.
Yes.
And what he says is, if you are looking for something that's already there, then it becomes lost and can never be found.
Wow.
And that's the situation with McLuhan.
Right. Now, you may not know this, but we put re in the beginning of all our products' names. Realign, restructure, remite, remake.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've just given, Carol's going to find that fun to hear, that we're in the McLuhan scene. And I say that Carol was one of Marshall's most popular female media ecologists. So she's carrying in his tradition with this read.
Good.
So we're in this cul-de-sac, and we already are. So that partly means that there is no cul-de-sac. If we're always already in there, then we get out of it somehow, or we don't need to get out of it. So that cancels the cul-de-sac.
Well, I would rather say that we're both in it and out of it.
But, okay.
As soon as you get into we're in it and then we're not in it, then you're into linearity, and there's a whole bunch of problems that get associated with linearity. So the big backwards flip, you could say, with McLuhan has to do with time. If we're involved in a linear sequence, then we can never, ever get out of the cul-de-sac.
Yes.
But if time is plural, if there is a all-at-once dimension to time, but also a linear one, then within time itself, there's a kind of gap. Within time itself, to which we are submitted, there is this recurrence, right? And
yeah.
It is that, this is another tie of McLuhan to very deep thoughts about things. This gets into Being and Time, which was Heidegger's great book in 1927.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea in Being and Time is that the coming to terms with the plurality of time is the sort of the essential clue to figuring out what's going on with being, with the big B.
Right. Do you like the phrase, the idea that there's always two conversations going on? That's the parallel?
Very much. But not two. Many, many, many. McLuhan often talks about that in terms of the unconscious and how there's this great background murmur or mumble of all of these voices, and what human beings are, both individually and socially, is some selection or some combination of these incoming voices.
That's the big shock of the electric environment. It unleashes that definition of the unconscious. All these voices.
Absolutely. Correct.
Which makes Joyce's Phineas Wake, even Ulysses, so appropriate, so accurate mirror of the situation. It's pretty incredible, his genius.
Yes, sir.
In showing multiple voices. But then Eliot was in on it too, right? He says, somebody
Absolutely.
Does the police in many voices.
That's right. That was the original title of The Wasteland.
Right. Okay. Since we're talking about my essay here,
yeah.
I get us out of the cul-de-sac or do what's demanded, I do bring in, as you say, many voices. I'm assuming we got to get out of the cul-de-sac a little bit, or half the story is getting out of it. Do I do it with my paper? What do you think?
Well, I would say yes and no.
Okay.
Right? The one part of the book that I would argue against is its recourse to linearity a lot.
Yeah.
But then what you say to that is, well, I got to use words when I'm speaking to people.
So, I got to use linearity when you're reading me.
That's right. Well, a book is linear, right? The lines on a page are linear. The letters in a word are linear.
Yeah, I was very relaxed about going linear.
That's right. Oh, well, you love linearity.
Yes, I have an old POB, I guess, in some ways. When I'm not on the radio, I'm an old POB.
Well, we have to be.
Yeah.
Right? That's one of the great failings of McLuhan scholarship, is that it gets itself involved in what he called values.
Yes.
Right? For McLuhan, it's essential that every possible variant of human experience should be subject to positive evaluation, you could say, or positive signification. There is nothing that human beings experience that is somehow outside the pale. And in Joyce, you have that for sure, right? I mean, that's a central principle of what he was doing.
Right, you're saying outside valuation? Nothing's outside valuation?
Yeah, but I'm using valuation there in a crazy way, because I on the one hand, I was saying that McLuhan doesn't want to value things above other things, and then I used valuation simply to mean taking everything in and discarding nothing as valueless. But I shouldn't have used value in two different ways like that. I just meant that for McLuhan, you cannot take any experience, be it electronic, be it print, be it primitive, and place it in some kind of linear sequence where one is better than the other.
Right.
Right. That's why the electronic is a replay or a retrieval or a recognition of the primitive.
Yes. Okay. So. In conversation, I'm sitting with you at a restaurant reading, and I ask you to pass the butter. You could make that into a philosophical question. It's interruption, what philosophers do, or maybe that's a replay. But maybe anybody, to interrupt people in their what they're doing is irritating. And to bring up the medium as the message, that's another interruptory proposal. But all philosophers or all thinkers or anti-environments maybe are interrupting. And so in that sense, McLuhan continues the interrupting process, maybe deeper than anybody else of his time. He interrupts more of what people think they're doing.
I agree. That's very important to the cul-de-sac.
Yes.
Right. If the cul-de-sac is sort of a fate of modern thought, but not just of modern thought, of modern politics, of modern ecology, that fate is one that Nietzsche saw, and already in the 1880s, Nietzsche saw that we were rushing into a fate that would have a catastrophic end, and no one knew a way out. That it was like a runaway train that all of Europe and all of the world was on. If that's the case, and I think it is the case, then nothing is more necessary than to interrupt the cul-de-sac.
Yeah, yeah. What kind of disaster did Nietzsche image? Would World War One be something he was thinking of, or was it more Armageddon or more disease? What do you know?
Well, I don't know that Nietzsche, of course, was in some ways an anti-Christian philosopher. Right, one of his last books was called The Antichrist.
Right.
So I don't know that he would like to use Christian imagery, but he definitely foresaw world wars and the sort of catastrophic struggles that would be unleashed by what McLuhan might call the end of the book culture, and an inability to interrupt that end into something else.
Yeah. Okay, so media ecology is definitely the way McLuhan applied it. You know, by the time of his Playboy interview, he was saying, you know, we need to turn off the TV environment for a few weeks. Now, I have a quote in my book, Fatty Communion. He says that in about 1949, that quote in an article, maybe it's Time and Life and the Psychopathology of He says, we must stop. We must turn off this, turn off radio, turn off. Do you know that quote?
Yeah, I do. And I know that there's actually quite a few quotes that are like that. We discussed this in a prior conversation a little bit. And my view is that McLuhan is talking there not in very precise, not in very technical terms. He's trying to get people to understand sort of what the new world possibilities are. But these ideas that, you know, we all know what television is, and we all know what a country is, so we'll just turn off the TV in that country. All of these terms are actually useless in electronic environment. And so he's not saying something straightforward there. He's saying something that takes some sophistication to understand what he's up to.
Right. So let me see if I can find it. What did he say? Turn, maybe just turn off. That'll bring it up. I've got all my content here. So I'm trying to find that quote. Let's see.
Should I be talking while you look, or should I?
No, it's all right.
You
it
concentrate?
Would be agonizing, I think he said. So I'm putting that word in to see if that brings it up. No, it didn't do it. I'll just have to scan down here. Because it is an interesting statement he makes.
That's right. But the I would say the important thing to understand there is what he's talking about is how do we situate ourselves in an electronic environment?
Yeah.
And so then within an electronic environment, what does it mean to begin to have new ways of understanding how human beings act both individually and socially, and what sort of tools will be available to us through this new kind of research and new kind of understanding in the electric environment. It would be wrong to think that he thinks that these words like country, thermostat, turning on, turning off, are to be understood literally.
You don't think that he meant to do an actual fast, turn something off?
The problem is that to turn off has a completely different meaning for book culture and electronic culture.
Okay.
Right, in electronic culture, to turn something off doesn't mean to sort of forget about something, right? In chemistry, for example, if you stop an analysis of one material and start a different analysis of another material, you're taking a step within chemistry, right? So you're not turning chemistry off, you're turning off a kind of focus. And it's something like changing your focus within the same dimension that I believe McLuhan is talking about when he talks about thermostats and turning on and off and stuff.
So when he talks about turning off radio for a few weeks in Venezuela because it's getting too heated, I think he means that technically, but what would be the metaphor there?
Notice that that's very linear, right?
Yeah.
At one moment, you have the radio on and it's causing problems. And so then somebody comes along and turns the radio off, and then you have it off for a certain length of time, and then you turn it on. All of that is structurally print. And that's certainly not what McLuhan had in mind. What he's trying to do there is it's a kind of a thought exercise. He wants students and anybody who's listening to him to begin to think about existing in an entirely new understanding.
Yes. So he just needs to say it. He just needs to have it applied.
Well, it's like you say lots of things in your book that you say, well, you know, I have to use words. And McLuhan is the same. McLuhan, in many ways, when he talks like that, is talking to himself. Because McLuhan often was kind of staggered, is a word he often uses, at the implications of what he can see, right? The implications that are involved in cybernetics. What happens when human beings at a much deeper level than ever happened before begin to assume responsibility for their fate, right? And this, when he talks about, you know, the world thermostat and all that kind of stuff, that's what he's talking about. It's the usual lazy McLuhan industry thinking to assume that, well, we know what Venezuela is, we know what a radio is, we know what turning on and turning off is, we know what 2 weeks is, and so that's what he was talking about. That just trivializes McLuhan.
Okay, interesting. I have it listed in my index of books, but I can't find the quote. So maybe I will. Maybe I can do it this way. Your thoughts are very interesting while waiting for me to find this. This is good.
So are you looking
for
something with thermostat?
No, I don't think he used that word that early.
You're looking specifically in the late 1940s stuff.
Well, I'm using the quotes I have in my own book, Fatty Communion. And I have at the end of the book, and this is a digital presentation of it, I have the articles I quote. So I'm trying to find where my quote is.
Right. But look at how germane the concept of the phatic is to what I was just saying. Right. What I was saying is that if McLuhan says in Venezuela we're going to stop the radio for 2 weeks, and then we're going to turn it on and all that stuff. The usual reading just goes from one island in the archipelago to the next, right? One
yes.
word that we know very well to the next word we know very well and all that sort of stuff. But it doesn't get to the phatic. And with McLuhan, the whole question is what's in between? What's in the gap? What is the sense that's at stake here?
Yes, I was quite proud of my title, Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. It's just like McLuhan drew attention to a word that nobody knew, media. I came up with phatic, and I organized and published the book myself in 92, and then I moved to New York City, and one day on the subway, I saw somebody, some kid, with a T-shirt that said phatic something. Phatic
mm-hmm.
Farm, mm-hmm. Something like that. So it took a while, and I found out that that was a early rap entrepreneur, hip-hop entrepreneur, had started a store using the word phatic, or fat, P-H-A-T. And then
Yeah.
Yeah, and I found out that was that generation's term for groovy or something, fat.
Yeah.
So I said, well, look at that. I come out of, quote, high culture, and I'm echoing something already in the zeitgeist in low culture, you know.
Mm-hmm. But much more than that, Bob. The whole idea of phatic communication, phatic communion, comes from Malinowski.
Yes.
And so here's Malinowski saying that if you don't understand the phatic in a primitive society, you just can't understand that society.
Right.
And he
that
was saying
book,
this.
That book has a big influence on Joyce, Duchamp, maybe some others, but, you know, and McLuhan.
Absolutely, on Richards, right? So The Meaning of Meaning by Richards has an essay by Malinowski as one of its appendices.
Which they just met him in 1922. He'd just come back from the Pacific Islands or
Correct.
Something. And
Correct.
They were so impressed, they held up the press probably to stick it in there. The end of the book.
That's right.
And you'll see McLuhan uses phatic communion sparingly, but it's there in early essays. He'll refer to it. Doesn't seem to talk about it, but he'll highlight the importance of the phrase phatic communication or phatic communion.
I didn't know he ever used the word, so that's interesting.
Oh, yeah, interior landscape. Have you got interior landscape there? Right handy?
No.
Okay, it's in, maybe I'll get a chance to go and get it, but it's in the first couple of pages, I think, in one of the Joyce essays, in Interior Landscape. Now, anyways, yeah, no, that's amazing. You know the importance of it, but you didn't know Marshall said it. He also says it in Cliched Archetype.
Yeah, no, I knew that. McLuhan was acquainted with it, I can see by doing a little searching around here, I can see that McLuhan used it already in his Richards and Leavis essay in 1944.
Yes. What have you got there? You
then
got all of McLuhan's works in one little place?
Well, I wouldn't say all, but I've got enough that I can do some fairly deep searching. He uses again in Joyce, Mallarmé, and the Press.
Right there. Now look at that sentence. That's important.
The one in that essay?
Yeah. You lead
okay,
into
let
it.
Me, all right. I'll have it for you in just a second here. This essay, by the way, was submitted, I believe, already in 1951, and then the Swanee Review took
three or four years
to get around to publishing it.
Yeah, they published it in 1953, I'm pretty sure, so 2 years.
Yeah. So he says here, the pictographic Chinese culture, for example, would seem to stand midway between the extremes of our abstract written tradition and the plenary oral tradition with its stress on speech as gesture and gesture as phatic communication.
Wow.
and it is perhaps this medial position between the non-communicating extremes of print and pictorial technology which attracts us today to the Chinese ideogram.
Right. So,
that's a tip of the hat to Pound, amongst other things.
Yeah, so he doesn't have phatic communion as an interval. It's at the other end, gestural communication.
No. He says that it's the interval. He says that it's between the two extremes. It's the medial position, he says.
Oh, he says phatic. Doesn't he say?
Well, wait a second.
Yeah, just read that carefully. He's saying between.
No, you're right. You're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, the abstract and the phatic.
Yeah.
But gestural includes its definition of ESP, nonverbal mental dance.
In this sense, it might, yes. Yeah. And in fact, this highlights one of the things I learned from our previous conversations is that I had to think more about the primitive and the replay of the primitive in electronic culture as the incoming of all voices.
Mm, yes, which is what you evoked in me 15 minutes ago. The unconscious, the extension of the unconscious is the electric age of multiple voices. And, you know, print made equitone, one voice, univocal.
Correct. But what we need to avoid, and what's very, very hard to do, something that McLuhan racked his brain about for about 40 years, is how to insist on both of those, right? In order to have the primitive awake, as in Finnegan's Wake, then you need to have something like a unitary consciousness of the plurality.
Yeah.
Right? And trying to figure out how to have both together without distorting either side is the trick.
Yes. Okay, so I found the quote.
Good.
So he says, so the process of renewal can't come from above. This is 1949, approximately. Uh-huh. So the process of renewal can't come from above. So that's the end of print hierarchical, the cathartic view of art, ethical moral art. The cognitive view is the horizontal symbolism in a wilderness of echoes. So in a way, that means you're in the cul-de-sac, right here, he's saying. There's no above outside of the cul-de-sac. You get that? So the process.
Yeah, definitely.
No,
that's very important. And that immediately gets us to how to be in the in-between.
Yeah.
Right? How to have the vertical and the horizontal together without ending up in only one of them.
Right. So the process of renewal can't come from above. It can only take the form of reawakened critical faculties. The untrancing of millions of individuals by millions of individual acts of the will. I'll say it again. The untrancing of millions of individuals by millions of individual acts of the will. Psychological decentralization. A merely provision. Now look at that. There he is. He's got his quote values of decentralization. And then he's either sees it or he's going to see it quickly. It's an environment decentralization. Which I think is different.
And he's speaking, remember we were talking about second sight?
Yes.
Right? McLuhan is talking to himself there.
That's right.
Get away from your centralized view of Roman Catholicism.
Right.
Get away from your idea of Leibniz's tradition. Get away from being a professor of literature.
Yeah. Psychological decentralization. Let me see this.
How to have psychological decentralization without going mad?
Isn't that his critique of Innes? Innes doesn't get the decentralization effect of radio, I think. Do you remember that?
It I believe he does say that, maybe in the later Innes essay.
Yeah, in 1953, the Queen's Quarterly.
Yeah. That may be so, right? I mean, Innes certainly got decentralization as a as something to be wished, right? So within when Innes looked at the politics of the British Empire and the politics of the American Empire, then what he wanted was decentralization. He wanted a place where Canada would have its own voice.
Yeah.
He wanted center and margin to
repair
the to be decentered, you could say. But he didn't. I don't think he saw that this was necessarily tied to modern technology and modern art. And McLuhan, I think, believed that, of course, Innes would see this as soon as he really concentrated on it, but he just didn't have time to do that.
Right. Did you know a friend of mine found out that the original meaning, or one of the meanings of repentance, is to retrace, to look back at what you've done. And McLuhan makes so much out of retracing the stage of apprehension. That's repentance.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see.
That's one more complex.
Yes. Okay, so he says psychological decentralization. That's one sentence. Or two words make up a sentence. That's not grammatically correct for the style of writing in criticism back then, would it? You wouldn't just go psychological decentralization, period. Isn't that a bit different for the time?
Yes, I think so.
It's
certainly a mark of McLuhan coming loose himself from the way that he used to write, for sure.
Yeah, he is. He's being oral there. Psychological decentralization, a merely provisional image of how it might, not how it should occur. So a merely image of how it might occur could be formed by supposing every mechanical agency of communication in the world to be suspended for 6 months. No press, no radio, no movies. Okay,
yeah.
So nobody's supposed to do this. He's just telling you, and most people probably hadn't even thought of this, though maybe old late grandmothers said, this is too much, you know. I always say, turn the radio off, you know, that kind of thing.
But read the start of that sentence.
A merely provisional image of how it might occur could be formed.
Stop.
Oh, I see.
A merely provisional image. That's what I was trying to talk about before.
That's good. Not how it should. Yeah, not how it should. How it might occur could be formed by supposing agencies be suspended for 6 months. Just people finding out who live near them, forming small communities within big cities. It would be agony. All psychological drugs cut off. No encapsulated thoughts or melodies. Okay, he is talking about it happening, but if it's a thought, he's telling you the thoughts you're going to have if you contemplated doing this merely provisional turn off. Did you get that? He's talking about it did happen, and certain things unfold. All psychological drugs cut off. Are you there? I don't hear you responding.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. All psychological drugs cut off. No encapsulated thoughts or melodies. To say that anything like this could never happen, or that it should never be allowed to happen, is a remark worthy of those mesmerized practical men who are efficiently arranging for the obsequies of our world's mind and body alike. You know, the world funeral. The burying. Isn't that amazing? If something like this doesn't happen, it's quite plain what will happen. There's your terrain collision.
Which essay is that from?
The Psychopathology, look it up. Oh, I think it's exactly called The Psychopathology of Time and Life.
Let me
let me scroll down a second, get the exact.
Yeah, that was an essay that he published in like three or four different places.
Yes,
so
first
he regarded it as important.
Yeah, first published in Neurotica. That's a bunch of bohos, art guys down in New York, right? Neurotica.
Yeah.
Issue,
yeah.
Volume 5 or Issue 5, 1949. And it was reprinted in a book Reinhardt put out called Seen Before You, : A New Approach to American Culture. And it's called Psychopathology of Time and Life. And Time and Life are in quotes and supposed to represent the two magazines. Psychopathology of Time. Endless news that time and life did. And that they would never stop. Right?
Yep.
So, what a great quote or great section. But, okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you see how, okay, it's merely provisional to think that you would do it, but then he must shift to the other side to continue the thought experiment to make it real and imply that he does want to do that.
Well, he does want to do something like that.
Yeah.
Right? That's where the provisional comes in. Right? The what McLuhan is trying to talk about is a new way for human beings individually and collectively to exist in the world. Right? So
yeah.
Then you have the problem of if it's a new way of existing individually and socially in a new world, how do you use language to indicate the way from one world to this other world? And that's
right.
Why this provisional comes in. It's a very difficult problem. You could say it's McLuhan's central problem. You often quote him as saying that communication is a miracle.
Yes.
And communication is a miracle because of exactly this problem of trying to talk across the gap between worlds.
Yeah, this is the cul-de-sac once again that we're in.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. The problem of talking across worlds is that you get yourself involved in a cul-de-sac that doesn't have the reach that you're attempting to extend.
Right. So I want to just read it again quickly, impact people. So the process of renewal can't come from above. It can only take the form of reawakened critical faculties, the untrancing of millions of individuals by millions of individual acts of the will, psychological decentralization. A merely provisional image of how it might, not how it should, occur could be formed by supposing every mechanical agency of communication in the world to be suspended for 6 months. No press, no radio, no movies, just people finding out who lived near them, forming small communities within big cities. It would be agony. All psychological drugs cut off. No encapsulated thoughts or melodies. To say that anything like this could never happen or that it should never be allowed to happen is a remark worthy of those mesmerized practical men who are efficiently arranging for the obsequies of our world's mind and body alike. If something like this doesn't happen, it's quite plain what will happen. Now, the each new medium, say TV, computer, satellite, is another interruption of the agenda that he's hoping people to focus on. We get distracted by a new environment, and maybe the novelty of it, we don't find it such a problem at first or such an irritation. But after 25 years of movies and radio and magazines and cars, all the media that he's dealing with in the late 40s, it's irritable. He's almost asking for a new medium to come in so we could forget the cul-de-sac. The repetition of the hot media environment of the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, you see, when you say we could forget, what you're talking about is something that's new. And he is talking about something that's new. He is talking about renewal
in
all of this. But once you put that into an all-at-once context, then it his what he's talking about here is becomes complicated, and it becomes complicated in that What he's looking for isn't a new situation with a new medium. It's a new way of existing with media.
New critical faculties. Reawakened. There it is again. Reawakened critical faculties, he said.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? And
yep.
So the key to this would be trying to understand how human beings are always, from every moment of their lives, they are going through a process of reawakening. That is to say, reinstalling a new mask, a new role, a new perception, but without knowing it. And so human beings, through this process of kind of automating their roles, just become robots.
Yeah. Now, is there anybody who did this, who took on the media environments the way McLuhan is in previous times? Or was it always the same questioning, same effort to reawaken critical faculties, but only on smaller scales, smaller media environments?
Well, my view is that the great thinkers, like Plato and Aristotle as two great examples, were always doing this. And so it's not that it hasn't been done. It's certainly not that it can't be done. It's just that we, as a species, we haven't found a way of going from the great insight of people like Plato and Aristotle to practical application. And so we have what might be called a distorted application that leads us to weapons of mass destruction and ecological disaster that is enabled by the partial application of these ideas without the application of their wisdom side.
Right, and so McLuhan's original view is that we've got to position a cul-de-sac where we can actually see what we're doing to ourselves. And he often
Correct.
Said that about the 20th century. It was the first time we could see what we were doing to ourselves with our main tools
yep.
as environments. So,
exactly.
So in that way, he's original.
We're forced to do it. We're
yeah.
forced to do it because electronic media and advanced transportation have forced us into conjunction with other peoples in a way that we can no longer ignore. And at the same time, in the academic environment, especially in anthropology and psychology, we're learning, and sociology, we're learning how we can't sort of stand aside and above societies, primitive people, insanity. We have to understand these things from the inside. And so once we encounter people in space that are not us, and once we encounter conditions of human being within us that are not us, then we have this whole new situation where we suddenly understand what it means to be in a world of voices.
Okay, so let's...
And notice that McLuhan then, when he puts out his anthology with his colleagues Shook and Sirlak, in the I think it's in the 1950s, could be the 60s, it's called Voices of Literature, right?
Yeah, that's 64, 65, and he did a couple
yeah.
of volumes.
Right, right. They were supposed to do a third, but it never appeared.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, so why are you bringing up those texts? They were for school.
Yeah, well, because of the title of the book,
oh, okay.
Voices of Literature, Voices.
Right.
Right, so it's a way, you could say, the title, Voices of Literature, is a way of going beyond literature to the voices that literature incarnates.
Right, so you're gradually... supporting how great your statement was that my book has many voices in it.
Correct.
I was part of a tradition.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, that's one of your interesting qualities in life, you know, as reflected in all of the different things you have going on the radio,
yeah,
and on the website and all that sort of stuff, is that you are different voices.
Yes.
There is no such thing as Bob Singular.
I even coined a psychological state. Psychological decentralization is quadriphenia.
Correct.
So, well, let's look at the beginning. I'm interested in what you find in the book. We wanted to sort of go back and start.
That's right. So, but one thing that I really don't understand very well, and that you could help me with, is what you think about the cul-de-sac. I mean, were you just throwing that out, or is there a background to that?
I was trying to show that there was a paralysis. And I was thinking of it as a temporary condition that could be broken. I certainly wasn't thinking that it is our fate to be forever in the cul-de-sac, the way you're taking it. I don't think I meant it that way. And another thing, the voices, the environment of simultaneity is so important.
Absolutely.
You know, in the 20th century. So
And let me just say something about that for a second. What happens, let's say, between 1900 and 1927 in physics, is that it comes to be understood that you cannot specify elementary particles, and in fact, you can't specify anything by taking a point of view on it. The only way you can understand particles is to understand them as a range of possibilities which get specified in various ways, but not specified ever in a way that definitively locates the particle. Right? You can have the particle in space, but you can't have it in time. Or you can have it in time, but you can't have it in space. And the way around that is to take all of the possibilities of the particle as a kind of incoming information, and then say that to understand the laws of this particle, you understand it as a specification of the range of possibilities. Well, that's what McLuhan and others like Eliot were saying about literature. Right? They were saying that the meaning of meaning, you could say, is that words have a vast range of possible meanings, and in a poem, the poet takes that vast range of possible meanings into consideration, and then uses the word in some precise way where precision has to do with how the word was selected out of that range of possibility.
Yeah.
Right?
Now,
so
go ahead.
Well, this relates to what we were talking about a few weeks ago with light through and light on.
Yes.
Right, and so in physics and in literature, you have a reversal, and the reversal goes from, instead of us directing a light on and illuminating out of our great genius, we turn around and we say the light is coming towards us, and our role is one of understanding those possibilities.
Right, now here's what I want to say. Don Thiel, I just want to get this in there because it applies. Don Thiel described how you read Finnegan's Wake, or what happens. Okay, so you take a couple lines of Finnegan's Wake, and there's no real continuity. Each word, each syllable is a rabbit hole of suggestions, multilingual suggestions.
Yep.
So he says, Joyce satirized the quantum perspective. as you read along the page, looking for linear connections to get the general drift and meaning of the sentence, you're hobbled by potholes where each word takes you away from some direction you're going, maybe the time, and throws you down a spatial hole of possibilities just within the 7 or 8 letters. So you can't figure out the linear meaning or the larger picture when you're reading, especially with the wake. He shows you're missing, you can't do the space and the time at the same time. Or he writes so that you are experiencing the quantum dilemma.
Correct.
Isn't that amazing? That's a
absolutely. It's
wonderful
it's
way
true.
To describe the experience of Finnegan's Wake. You go along and you can, so you have these outlines of Finnegan's Wake, which have nothing to do with the content of the book and the millions of stories in each page and, 50 languages. So to make a simple outline is to emphasize, I guess, the position of the particle and missing the spaces of the particle. And so Joyce showed that in the way he presented the sentence in Finnegan's Wake.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's something that's a very rare, I don't know anybody else who's ever said that. Thiel said it. I like to tell people that idea. So I took advantage of this situation to put that in here in the recording.
Right. But I think that Thiel took the idea from Joyce himself. I think Joyce was thinking along.
Well, that's what he's saying. He's saying that's what Joyce wanted to show. That's why Einstein is a big enemy or contrast or competitor for Joyce while writing it. Well, he actually told me through the Evergreens that he was trying to counter Einstein, one of his goals. He didn't think that the insights of Einstein were as important as what he had to say. And McLuhan agreed, because he said Joyce tackled problems that scientists didn't even know existed yet with Finnegan's Wake.
How can I say this? We always need to keep in mind with McLuhan that figure can become ground and ground can become figure.
Yeah.
Right? So when he talks, there's an inherent dynamic going on that's very important to respect. But there's a certain sense in which you can say that science in the 20th century can be seen as a figure on a ground of deeper problems.
Yeah.
Right? But
yes.
The reverse is also true. But
what is the reverse?
The deeper problems can be seen as figure on the ground of science.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Why did we get into this particular point?
Well,
the quantum. Why you brought up the quantum thing?
We were talking about cul-de-sac, and then I asked you what you meant, and you were talking about you got into Joyce.
Well, let me say this. I'll do it again. The cul-de-sac, and you're getting us into the metaphysics of it in a way. Or something like that, something deeper, I wanted to insult the cliches of McLuhanism. So cul-de-sac to me is not a desirable condition. So I wanted to say, we got ourselves into a serious problem here with these cliches that are all the people know about McLuhan.
Right.
So I was doing it for rhetorical effect, I guess. Right?
Right. Yeah, yeah. So then one question I have is you've also talked about, not in this book, but elsewhere, you talk about disappearance.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you bring disappearance together with the cul-de-sac.
Yeah, certainly. The disappearance, it's interesting. I talked about it, and then I found out that this French writer, Lyotard, L-Y-O-T-A-R-D, wrote a book, The Aesthetics of Disappearance. He was going on and on about it. And I said, wow. So I looked at his book, and of course, it's all abstract. It's not not an environmental thing. And I meant an environmental thing. We can't see where we're going. And McLuhan used to say that he walked around by feeling, you know, the blind man with his stick trying to see where to go. I mean, he totally said, we are invisible. We are not visible. And even Bucky Fuller pointed it out somewhere that he said, most of the developments in the 20th century are in the realm of the invisible. So technically, you know, we've disappeared in our environments and in our knowledge systems. And it's very helpful for a high school student to be told this properly and to get it. It would clear up a lot of muddledness because they're trying to visualize what wasn't visualizable. You know, I like the way McLuhan is very simple sometimes. You know, we're talking about this philosophical cul-de-sac, but he also was, at the other conversation, he provided good wrap-up statements about what knowledge had come to. So it was a very practical ending to modernism or to the vortices, what he offered. So, okay, that's one side of the conversation. But the other side is, well, no, it didn't work. Nobody got it, you know? And then you bring back the cul-de-sac. Do you think McLuhan was in a cul-de-sac personally? Was he a frustrated person?
Oh, I think so. I think so.
Okay, well, I spent more time with him than you did, and he was quite relaxed all the time. So is there a different kind of frustration you're talking about?
I think so. I mean, that relaxation you're talking about, I find that it's one of the really amazing things in McLuhan. Maybe he got it from his father.
Yeah.
Maybe it was his Irish side. Because, I mean, here's a guy whose his inability to communicate, right? He often talked about how he'd only had a handful of graduate students in his whole life that understood anything about what he was talking about, right?
Right, yeah.
And then you think about his family. The only one that remained Catholic was Eric.
Yeah.
And McLuhan wasn't entirely sure that Eric understood Catholicism the way he did. And so he's got his kids assembled to pray the rosary or something like this, and he knows that they all hate it, that none of them understand it, that he's forcing it on them from above, the sort of stuff that he hates elsewhere in life, right?
Yeah.
And so you would think that this is a person who's just tied up in all kinds of knots and anxieties. But then he comes across, as you say, as somebody without a care in the world.
That's right. I've got a couple of anecdotes to supplement this. Mary, who I got to know quite well, his daughter, one of his daughters, talked about how horrible it was growing up in his house. They had to pray. They had to do this. They had to do everything at dinner. They had, you know, incredibly strict world that people in the rest of suburbia didn't experience anymore, really. You know what I mean? Unless it were crazy.
Right.
Fundamentalists or something, the people, the extremists. Nobody knew that McLuhan was an extremist back at home.
Yeah, so he was struggling to communicate something.
Yeah.
Right? He was struggling to communicate with himself what it meant to be a Catholic in this new environment. He was struggling to communicate with his children what it meant to be a Catholic at all, right?
Yep.
He was struggling to communicate a kind of calling to remember a past world that wasn't really past, right? All worlds were present.
Yes.
And so he was struggling exactly with this question of language that we talked about earlier, where he was trying to communicate with the family, with his students, how to go from one world to another world, and the language was failing.
That's right.
The language was failing, and that failure was the cul-de-sac, was the fate.
Right, two more points. I think it's in that June Calwood interview, November 74 Globe and Mail, where he talks about having ESP. He may say it there. It's around this time. He says, people have trouble projecting to me, and I have trouble projecting to them. Now, this
Absolutely.
Is the great communicator.
Correct.
Oh, but then they'd say, who couldn't communicate? So, boy, he was a walking cul-de-sac. And let me see, was there another point? So Mary talked about how painful it was being – oh, and Carol met a woman, student in the 70s who grew up in high school or whatever with the McLuhan kids, and she brought up McLuhan, and they get talking. And then this sort of family acquaintance said, boy, he really wrecked his kids, though. He ruined his kids. This was the jargon of some of the people in their peer group. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know what Mary and Terry were doing, but it's interesting, the confusion around him. And then Corinne says, Marshall, he loved the idea of family. He wasn't really a good family man. And Mary said all he did was sit on the couch reading poetry, and Corinne ran the family, or, you know, create a sense of familyness. He was in love with
right.
the idea of family. And then they go back to what I told you the last time. He wanted to infiltrate decent society. He was a loner, eccentric artist, in the cliche way we think of the history of artists, trying to look bourgeois for some reason. He knew that
right.
the underground wasn't possible anymore. You couldn't have, you just end up stranded and isolated. And he didn't want to do that because he wanted to communicate to people. He really
right.
he really loved to communicate.
But notice that you're using communication there as a kind of stretching between roles. So,
yes.
McLuhan wanted to be an artist, but he also wanted to be a father with six children. And almost nobody else could do that, right?
Yeah.
He wanted to be a revolutionary, but also an academic. So McLuhan's whole sort of thrust of thought is to embody and to be these different voices.
Right. I was just thinking, he was very impressed with Wyndham Lewis. He even said he dedicated his life work to Lewis. Maybe he wanted to do Lewis better, since Lewis had some personality mm-hmm. failings and caused problems with his paranoia. He said, okay, I got to do Lewis better. You know what I mean? I don't want
right.
to be isolated. That might have been his strategy.
At other times, he was very critical of Lewis.
Yep.
Too vertical, too print-oriented,
yep.
too papal, you could
Didn't
say.
Didn't know what tactility was.
Yeah, yeah. So, I know, he certainly felt a debt of gratitude to Lewis and expressed that in ways that he didn't do so much for other people.
Yeah.
I mean, he owed a tremendous amount to Jill Soan. But usually when he talked about Jill Soan, it was critical.
Yeah.
Right? But
yeah.
Jill Soan is the person he cites more than anybody else in the thesis. And Jill Soan was the guy that kind of gave him a central clue in the 1950s. Right. Jill Soan had given him some essential clues around 1940 for how he was going to apply his Catholicism. And then in the 50s, McLuhan was in a cul-de-sac and trying to get out. And Jill Soan gave the art lectures in Washington. I forget their name, but both Jill Soan and Maritain did that. And that led McLuhan into a new understanding of art and a new understanding of media, so that just a year or two after Jill Soan and Maritain had lectured in Washington on art and turned McLuhan on to Gombrich and to Ivins and to other people in the world of art theory, he then comes up with the idea of medium as the message and goes on from there.
Right. Okay. I was just
sorry about that one.
No, that's good. But I just was thinking about many people saw him as incredibly energized and happy and, you know, full of fun.
Yeah.
Huge
energy, no question about it.
Right. So he's got all this energy, yet people thought that his message in the 60s was very cold, you know, inhuman, post-human. That's when he got up on the podium, I guess. So then he's doing the monologue, and he's being one-directional. Not his style, but his effect. But in daily interaction, collegial and a fun guy. I'm just trying to think, when was he mean? When was he depressed? I can't think of it. He never ended a lecture on a depressing point. He's, quote, an optimist in effect. He said, we can do something about this. All we have to do is understand me. and then we're okay. So I was just thinking about that, the range of depression and mania.
Mm-hmm. I think the clue there is to think of them not as dominant, right? The McLuhan read a lot of Jung in the 1930s and 40s. And he was familiar with the idea that we don't have moods and we don't have things like depression and mania. They have us, right? So this was one of the clues to McLuhan that voices are incoming.
Yes.
And when he comes to understand the electronic environment, it will be as a plurality of voices that are incoming, as opposed to the book culture of one voice that's outgoing.
Right.
So when he understands this plurality of voices that are incoming and that include things like depression and mania, then you can see that in his own personality, there could be something like depression, but not as a single dominant.
Right.
It was a component voice of the spectrum that was incoming.
Yeah.
Right. And so the energy and the agony of McLuhan was the attempt to do justice to all of these voices, including how to communicate what they could give us if we could understand what was going on with them.
And then on top of that, what was unique is to see the whole situation you're describing. It was an environment. That's what
people did. Yeah, environments, plural.
Yeah, environments, plural. Two things. In his essay on Lewis in 53, he talks about Lewis being a god, having a genius as a god-obsessed mania. I think that phrase is in there.
That makes sense. He wouldn't have intended that as a compliment, I don't think.
No, but he recognized it and he suffered it himself.
Yes, absolutely. One of the voices, yeah, absolutely.
And I don't know what the other point was for right now. So let's go.
Let me just say in regard to that essay that I don't think that much of that was new in 1953. I think what he did was take a bunch of stuff that he'd written earlier, maybe even in the 1940s,
yep,
and chucked it together into an essay.
Well, this is what Clinton's is discovering. He's gotten access to stuff we can't see. You got to get special permission, and he's just shocked at the crazy personality writer, pissed off person of the 40s compared to the relaxed guy of the 50s. You know, that's what Clinton is shocked at.
Yeah.
So we get, he reads little excerpts to us, so it's pretty amazing. So, yes, a lot of what's in Mechanical Bride, which many older, angry people like Mechanical Bride. That's old-fashioned peak. But there's so much of it in the 40s. Mechanical Bride was a an outline, a watered down distillation of very productive writing in the 40s. In this temper, you know, that phrase temper, ill temper, superiority complex. There was a guy obsessed or possessed by something in the 40s. Personal possession that maybe all genius is. Somebody's got an allergy to stuff that most people aren't allergic to.
Correct. Absolutely, absolutely. But just think of McLuhan there. He's got an allegiance to the church. He's got an allegiance to his family. But those conflict in a way that by teaching in a Catholic institution, he's not making any money. So he's crapping on his family in a certain way.
Yeah.
He's forcing a certain life on Corinne that isn't very comfortable. I think somebody says somewhere that she didn't even have a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so he's got this large family to which he owes affection and allegiance, and he somehow has to bring that into some kind of orchestration with his calling to be an artist, and at the same time he really doesn't know what the hell he's doing. He's got to find a whole new personality, a whole new environment, both for himself and for the family and for his students. And he's wondering if he should even remain an academic. Maybe he should throw in with Mueller team and become some sort of business guy, right? So there's a cauldron going on inside McLuhan that he has to try to orchestrate.
And then he loves Lewis's doctrine in Brass that at mid-career you have to do a total backflip and become something else. So he does that between the 40s and 50s. He does the backflip and becomes another person, which shocked people that knew him back then. It was a famous critic at Montreal. I went to his lecture in the late 60s at McGill, and Neil Compton or one of those other guys that are in Hot and Cool, I think, or Pro and Con, and he was shocked at what the 60s McLuhan was compared to the moralistic outrage guy of what he thought the Mechanical Bride era. He just thought, what the hell? He dropped all his morals. He's accepting too much around him. Hanging out with Hubert Humphrey. This is what Ted Carpenter objected to. But McLuhan had found a way to be a flow, to flow through all the different environments.
Yeah.
He communicated on a broader scale. I was told by Jim Stewart, Mark Stewart's husband, that when Eric was young, if Eric was playing with little trucks and toys, Marshall would come out and tromp on them. He was so upset about some kid becoming a gadget lover. Now, that's very violent. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So,
by the way, we brought up Mary a while back. I meant to point out that best man at McLuhan's wedding was Mueller team. And then when Eric was born, Mueller team was Eric's godfather.
Yeah.
And then when the twins were born, they needed to run around and find grandparents. And so Mueller team was also the godfather of Mary.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He was such an important person in that.
She died just a couple of years ago, right?
She died in July 30th, 31st, in 2019. And I hadn't talked to her in about 6 months. And then I was away through July and August. I got back on August 12th, you know, last year, 2019. And on the phone, I have a old-fashioned phone. You know, it takes voicemails and landline stuff. And she was asking me to get in touch with her, and that was July 25th, and she said she wanted to discuss something. So then I go and check my email, and there's an announcement that Mary died 5 days later, on July 30th.
Yeah.
So I failed to meet my appointment with her before she died.
Mm.
And then Eric had died just a year, just a little over a year before, in 2018.
Right.
So, I would say Mary was very opposite to Eric. They were very strong opposite personalities.
Correct.
And you know, Eric was the son who remained a Catholic and took on his father's work. And Mary was the one that everybody in the family said was Marshall's favorite among the girls.
Yeah.
So the two favored kids. Were quite well. Eric was not extreme. Mary was. Mary was outgoing. Eric was more introverted, I guess. At least I saw him that way. He may not have been that way.
I think he was.
Yeah. But he was a jazz musician or played the piano.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He. One of the things about Eric, I didn't know Eric as well as you did. I knew him personally, and one of the interesting things about Eric was that he could punctuate conversation or punctuate his life with surprising things, surprising observations or a jump, and
yes.
that aspect of McLuhan he had.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Mary eventually. Well, I visited her 2013 up in Oregon. She was living in some town, begins with M.
Ashland.
No, she was in Ashland, then she moved to Medford or something.
Oh, Medford, yeah.
Yeah, maybe Medford.
That's in the general area of south of Oregon.
Yes, and she told me that it was a drug dealing center for years.
Mm-hmm.
Major drug dealers were there. Anyways, she had two friends, acquaintances, cleaning her house and this and that. And after an evening of me interacting with her and the quote maids, guy and girl, she said to me the next day, she said, "You know, you're exactly like my father. You can talk to anybody." She was very impressed with how I could talk to these two people. Who, of course, didn't know anything that about what I was interested in. And Mary observed this. So I thought that was interesting that I had a bit of I understood his going out and being congenial and interviewing everybody. You know what I mean? He
mm-hmm.
would talk to people
sure.
all over the place.
Yeah, that's what I said earlier is that there is no one Bob. There's
yeah.
a million different Bobs. Yeah.
Yeah. Hypocrite lector, hypocrite social, what would it be for social mixer? Hypocrite social mixer. You know that quote from Baudelaire, hypocrite lector?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. yeah.
Okay, I want you to go into the beginning of the book. I want to see how you try to go somewhere with the beginning. How do we get out of the cul-de-sac, or how I attempt to do it, or...
Well, I mean, I think that's something that you should enlighten me on, not me enlighten you, but it's
okay.
your book.
Let's see.
I mean, you start off by talking about arrogant superiority.
Yes.
And we've talked a little bit today about the refusal of the vertical. And so then the question becomes, you know, how are we to understand these things together, right? How can you have arrogant superiority without sort of throwing your allegiance onto verticality?
Right.
And
remember, this is all applied to understanding Donald Trump.
Yeah.
That's what the book's called, What We/You Didn't Know About Trump.
Correct.
So, and there is this, have you seen that other article by someone none of us know who wrote about Trump reading McLuhan's interview in Playboy when Trump was 23 and quick mind or quick whatever it was that he had, maybe, you know, acquiring knowledge superficially, but he got key points from McLuhan that created his public personality when he went into politics. Have you seen that essay?
No. Is it at New Explorations, or where is it?
No, it's online. Playboy, McLuhan, and Trump. I could send it to you, but it's something called Windows, website.
Okay, I know that guy, yeah. I mean, I know of him. I certainly don't know who he is or where he is, but, no, I know that website. I'll look it up.
Yeah, but you haven't read that article.
No.
Yeah, like the way Trump is discontinuous, he saw McLuhan sort of talking about it probably as a value, Trump had interpreted it as, in the Playboy interview, and a whole bunch of other factors. And I noticed the guy quoted a couple of quotes that I'm probably the only one who puts out there. So he may have been influenced by my essay on McLuhan as a Quadrophenia person, mm-hmm. Quadrophenic. So anyways, I wanted to do a better version of that guy's essay. You know what I mean? Make it broader,
yes,
bigger,
sir.
And bring it up to the present. So I'm going to explain Trump by going through the six phases: Global Village, Global Theater, Global Membrane, or Android Meme Phase 1, Android Meme Phase 2, then the Anthropomorphic Physical, and then the Tech Body. And
right.
Once
again, the big difference between us is that I always want to know how these things are contemporaneous, and with you, they're more linear. And
describing a non-linear personality, Trump, non-linear world, but I have to, I don't normally write something. Okay? So it's a minor sidebar for me to go linear. So I don't
correct.
Think I should be criticized as that's me. I'm not a linear person.
Yeah. I'm not criticizing. What I'm trying to do is put my finger on something that's very difficult to understand. It doesn't matter if we're talking about McLuhan or anything else. And that is that it's not the case that there's only all-at-onceness. And it's not the case that there's only linearity. It's that there's both. And the whole calling of human beings is to try to understand that duplicity between times.
Okay, but I would say the Gutenberg Galaxy made people reduce it to those two. Pre-literate people like Julian James was trying to say multiple voices, they had more conflict than the eye versus the ear, say, or discontinuity versus linear. That could be only seen and experienced by Gutenberg people. What do you think?
I'm not sure I understand.
You're saying the two conversations, eye and ear, and he puts that in his books, but those are books. See, when he puts eye, comma, ear, and visual space, all these dialectics, he emphasizes them in books because the book is dialectical. And it splits things. So he mimes the method of the book or the bias of the book. So
right.
You think it's an eye versus ear. But it's the other senses that he's dealing with when he's not writing, when he's talking or teaching or walking around or performing in various happenings. He's dealing with the proprioceptive, the kinetic, the osmic, the tactile, the synesthetic. You know,
right.
He's not a dialectician.
Correct. And I like I don't want to say the direction you're going with this, but I will say it. The direction you're going with that, I think, is very interesting, right? Because it leads in to exactly the ball of problems that I was just speaking about.
Yeah.
Of the linear and the non-linear, and trying to do justice to both.
The third thing, the in-between thing is the tactile, the phatic, the ESP, the second sight. That's
correct.
Maybe what I'm saying outside of the books.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think that's exactly what you're saying, and it's very interesting. It's we could even go to Joyce here and say that human beings are called to a certain kind of justice between all these different voices, but at the same time are incapable of that justice.
Right. Is that an actual quote?
No, no.
Oh, okay.
No, no, no.
You're summarizing.
Yeah, it's like the fall of man, the fall
right.
of Finnegan. It takes place through that dynamic.
Yeah, where's the... when McLuhan said in Hot and Cool, I think it was, that communication on the matching level was very rare. Did anybody else ever say something like that? Maybe they talked maybe in terms of values, sin or something. People just aren't tolerant enough or they don't listen enough. But McLuhan said, no, communication is very hard. It's innate.
Right.
You know?
Yes. Yeah, imagine something being innate that was hard, right? That's a conundrum right there.
Innate,
right?
That was hard, did you say? H-A-R-D?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, for example, you could say breathing is innate to humans.
Yeah.
But it therefore, it's not hard, right? But what McLuhan is talking about is something that's innate that is hard.
Right, and in the... The final, one of the final, maybe the final recorded interview, Nelson found it from somebody. He's out there in Las Vegas or someplace at a conference in like May 79. So he's going to have his stroke in a couple of months. And he was telling the interviewer that he was more involved in suffering, not happiness. He says, I am not desiring to be happy. And he went on
right.
about his suffering and struggle that way. Maybe that's
uh-huh.
an acknowledgement of the hard.
Absolutely. He, his whole life long, he said that, you know, happiness was not something that he cared about and wasn't
yeah.
aiming for. A professor I once had wrote an essay called Happiness is for Pigs.
For pigs.
Herman Tennyson.
Okay, but it's not a sentiment among people. I mean, the whole educational culture is to make you find your role, your job, to make you happy, right? That's the whole bias of, I don't know, bourgeois
That's right.
culture
That's
or something.
Right. But imagine if you're a father of four kids, then five kids, then six kids. One of the most important things you have to do in life is instill a sense of happiness in your children.
Yeah.
And to keep, you know, right?
Yeah.
And you have to do this not only for them, but for your wife.
Yeah.
And for her relationship to the children and stuff like that, right? So the tensions in McLuhan as a result of what we're talking about here, not caring at all about happiness, and yet having to have that as one of the main goals in your life, as regards your kids and your wife, that's a difficult situation.
Yeah, so that's so when he breaks Eric's toys, he's not concerned about Eric's happiness. He wants to wake Eric up, like in a sense he didn't think children were incapable of being developing critical faculties.
Right, right. But as you said before, I mean, this is almost insane, right?
Yeah.
How do you bring up a child to be, you know, sort of a happy participant in the world by stomping on their toys? And,
you know, but then that's what that's the cliche. Genius is very close to madness. Now, I like what I said a little earlier. They've got an allergy. Mozart's got an ear allergy, right? He can't take...
Yeah.
normal soundscape, so he has to beautify it somehow or fix it. I think Zappa was like that too. But any sense, and then you have a genius of that sense and their art forms, they're allergic to it. But, McLuhan has at the end of War and Peace, they asked Mozart, what music do you like? And he said, no music. Actually, an artist is someone who invades a particular sense modality and fuck with it. They don't like it. They want to ruin it for other people.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a, if you think of Mozart on one end of a spectrum and modern art on the other end of the spectrum, then you have somebody who almost instinctively can bring delight to anybody. That's Mozart. And then on the other end, you have people who are repulsed by delight.
Yes.
And there we are.
I just read a quote by that recently died, or he died maybe 10 years ago, Wallace or David somebody. He was the best novelist for the Generation X. David somebody, Wallace or something. Forget his name. He was a very popular novelist for his generation. Then he died. But he said the writer is... really desiring to be liked, but at the same time he hates the reader.
Mm-hmm.
So that would tend to make you a manipulative writer. You're trying to get people to like you and what you're writing, but at the same time you hate the reader. Now that sounds, that's McLuhan or maybe most artists.
Mm-hmm.
They hate their medium. They're very divided. Okay, so if humans are always divided and conflicted, the genius is someone who takes some aspect of the human faculties and heightens, exaggerates the division, the contradiction, the battle.
Well, I mean, that's one, you could say one way to get out of the cul-de-sac is what you're describing.
Yeah.
To attempt that.
Yeah.
Right? But McLuhan's way to get out of the cul-de-sac is different from that. And that's because what you're talking about there is, let's say you have a conflict between the vertical and the horizontal. You're saying, well, we'll just emphasize the horizontal, or we'll just emphasize the vertical, right? You're saying that the artist is going to take some definitive position on some sense or some medium. But McLuhan's answer is to see the cul-de-sac as one voice, or at least as the result of one voice. Or perhaps you could say of a certain number of voices, but that are optional. They were able to get away from those voices, not by denying them, but by seeing the wider spectrum in which they have their role.
Well, seeing it as an environment which hadn't been seen before. He sees the environment, doesn't get him out of the cul-de-sac.
Yeah, it does, because the McLuhan insists in his conversations with Harry Skornia,
yeah,
is that there's no such thing as a medium.
Right.
There is media, and if you want to understand the medium, you have to understand its relationship to media. And it's the same thing with environment. There is no such thing as an environment. Everything that McLuhan writes about from the very beginning to the very end has to do with multiple approaches, you could say, multiple environments. And the idea is that you can only understand one of them by understanding their family, right? So if you want to understand what somebody, what some dialectician says in the 1200s, you have to understand that dialectical text against the trivium.
Say it again, the dialectical text against the trivium?
Yeah, you have to understand it as a kind of selection, not necessarily a conscious selection, but the if you want to understand dialectics in any text, you have to understand that a series of choices have been made to get to that point. A series of not necessarily conscious choices, and certainly not linear choices, choices that are synchronic and largely unconscious, have brought somebody from the possibilities of the trivium to the particular concentration on dialectics. And that way of looking at things is pretty much a constant for McLuhan from 1940 to 1980.
Yeah, now you said you're seeing the service of the univocal. Did you suggest that in there a couple of minutes ago?
I didn't use that phrase, but it certainly is closely related to what I'm talking about.
Okay, so in the early 50s, he maybe in Explorations, he wrote about what's the role of the book in our culture. I think he figured out how to rejuvenate the book. He felt that he found a new thing to write about in a different way that got people reading again or reading intensely. So when he said, you know, he doesn't say that I solved the problem, but he says, what is the role of the book? It's obviously obsolete in so many ways, obsolete in the different meanings of obsolete, and it's not constitutive. So why have a book? Why do books? I think he felt he had solved, that's the E equals MC squared question or whatever. He came up with a formula of how to use books to probe people and be long-lasting, to be, well, I guess, enter the world of philosophy or the classical questions. So what do you think of that idea, that he solved the role of the book?
No, I think that's very, very important. And I would rephrase it in the following way. McLuhan saw the book as central to Western civilization. He saw Western civilization as central to private identity, democracy, everything that we hold dear.
Yeah, and Christianity.
So then if the book is that central to our civilized lives, and if the book is dying, then if we want to protect our civilization and rejuvenate it, then we have to find what you just called a new role for the book.
Yeah.
And how do we find a new role for the book? Well, we find that the meaning of the book derives from the spectrum of media. And by understanding that spectrum of media and by understanding the virtues of different components of the spectrum, we come to value the book in a whole new way.
Yeah.
It's not an exclusive valuation anymore. It's an inclusive valuation, right? It's inclusive in McLuhan always means two-sided that are in dialogue. That's what inclusion is. And exclusion is two-sided, not in dialogue.
Right. So, Okay, so he felt... Oh, okay, you want to say some more?
No, go ahead.
Okay.
I coughed.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Okay, so he saw Finney's Wake solve that problem, but he had to translate it. But he indicated that Joyce thought he solved it on page 52 where it says, television kills, this is in Finney's Wake, television kills telephony and brothers broil. The eyes demand their turn, the book demands its turn. Let them be seen. So McLuhan wrote a book about what the book does to the eyes and the act of seeing and showing you how the eyes are seen. So let them, the eyes demand their turn. Let them be seen. That's a statement of what I was just talking about, solving the book problem.
Correct. We were both talking about that.
Yeah.
Because just as I was talking about the book as a component of the spectrum of media, so is the eye a component of the sensory spectrum.
Yeah. Right? Yep.
And the way to value the eye, according to McLuhan, is not to see it as the dominant sense or sacred sense or something like that. It's to see it in terms of the spectrum where it has its particular use. If we think in terms of chemistry, it's absurd to think that some elements are better than another, but it's not absurd to think that for some purposes an element is better.
Yeah.
Right? If you want to breathe, I'd advise you to get some oxygen.
Have you seen the quote? Well, actually, I just forgot what it was. Let me think for a second. What were you? We're just talking about the eye and the value of the eye. I may have lost it.
The
rare
sensory
quote.
Spectrum, or in relation
yeah.
to the book, or the role of the eye. You were talking about the quote out of, I think it was from Counterblast,
yeah.
about Brothers Broil.
Well, that's from page 52 of Finnegan's Wake, but he quotes it a
yeah,
lot
but it's,
throughout
it's
the year.
Quoted by McLuhan.
Yeah. It's almost his favorite quote from Finnegan's Wake. The eyes demand their turn, let them be seen. Okay, I can't remember right now. It'll probably come
mm-hmm.
back.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at my book, and I'm going to explain the tech body, which is, refers to something no one knows about unless they talk to Ion. Ion came up with the term. And
mm-hmm.
To keep it part of the mysterious, I'm not even going to explain what Ion is. The point is, I want to show that McLuhan predicted the tech body, which is what Ion said, that McLuhan, his greatest achievement was predicting the tech body. Yeah, but nobody knows what the tech body is unless you
mm-hmm.
listen to Ion.
But isn't my impression, this is a side of your thought that I really don't know much about, but my impression is that you've always had a series of what might be called animated fates, right? So
animated what? Fates?
Fate, F-A-T-E, fate. Animated fates. Some people have an understanding of what a fate might be like, but they don't think of it in terms of animation.
Right.
Right. Whereas you very much like the idea of what might be called a non-human animation.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. And it seems to me that back in the 80s already, I think you were talking about
yep.
Rumpelstiltskin.
Yep.
Right, and then you were talking about the Android meme.
Yes.
And I see the tech body is sort of...
the later development.
These things. Yeah, exactly.
So I want to show that McLuhan anticipated that because Ion said that. So I'm going through the quotes, or what I can find of McLuhan's work, that would lead to that. And what helps me bridge to the Android meme from normal machines, though I think the Luz and Guattari, they call it machinic. That was an attempt to bring in what McLuhan is saying in two things. In understanding media, he's saying electric environments are organic as opposed to mechanical and stiff, say. But in 68, in War and Peace and Globe Village and in his Playboy interview, which he uttered around the same time, he's saying that the new electric environment is a living, organic phenomenon. He's beginning to see the HAL of 2001, you know, that this thing,
mm-hmm.
the computer technology that is a common paranoid vision today, that technology is out of control, it's in charge and taken over. And there is a big documentary, very popular, called The Social Dilemma, which intuits that and deals with that problem. Have you heard of that?
I've heard of it, but I haven't bothered
haven't seen
to look
it. Yeah.
at it. Yeah. But let me just interject, Bob. Notice how this relates to a lot of what we've talked about today and even before today, and that is that McLuhan in the 1940s basically had to come away from the idea of his mind or the mind of the critical theorist as a kind of searchlight that illuminates the Western tradition.
Yes.
Through its questioning and stuff. He had to come away from that to a notion of incoming voices, only one of which was like that searchlight.
Yes.
And the some of this was from Jung, because Jung sees the different possible manifestations of personality as collective and as animated, as different kinds of gods, right?
Yeah.
And so McLuhan had this notion of what might be called superhuman animation, and as an incoming animated voice. He had this in his consciousness from the late 1930s, but he wasn't able to integrate it with his critical thinking for maybe 15 years or something. That was sort of what was going on in his mind in the early 1950s, right? And then he had to find, once he had some notion of this, how to integrate these things, he then had to find some way to communicate it. And it was here that art theory and film theory came to intrigue him. And so he developed a way of talking about these things out of art theory and film theory that led to The Medium as the Message in 1958.
Right.
So that's just the McLuhan background of what I hear you saying.
Yes.
About the development of the tech body.
Yeah, and The Mechanical Bride, you know, he tells his mother, is a new kind of science fiction. New kind.
Right.
He was a science fiction writer. And Theo was the first to tell me that he thought, you know, Wyndham Lewis, more obviously, is a science fiction writer, but that Finnegan's Wake was an incredible science fiction. And so McLuhan's going to translate Finnegan's Wake and update it. And he's going to update all media, including the book. So you're right to say the book is only one-fifth of the project. He's going to update what's happening to humans, what's happening to machines, how they're evolving. And so my thesis is that Donald Trump is, I don't want to say post-human, inhuman, non-human, whatever other hyphenated things, he is the tech body. And the tech body created the strange situation in 2016 and is creating the strange situation we have today. It's taken over the news. You could say the news came alive and is orchestrating everything. This is what Ion says. So I was trying to make McLuhan, you know, to bring McLuhan up to what's happening today, which a lot of young people perceive naturally. The things I'm saying when I bring it up with kids, they have no problem that the environment's alive and messing with us. They sort of maybe are intrigued with it, you know. They're not, they know it's there and they're figuring out how to live with it. Whereas previous generations, they can't imagine it's there yet. And they do this in the social dilemma. They say, well, our worst fear is about technology taking over from us. People think hasn't happened yet. They try to say it has happened. Our worst nightmares have arrived. And I'm showing it in the news, in the phenomenon of Donald Trump. And I'm saying McLuhan saw that. And so,
definitely, when he said the bomb is our environment.
Yeah, the way he talks about the bomb was incredible. That's probably the first thing I read back in the 60s that I didn't understand. You know what I mean? Like, what is he saying? The bomb's an information environment? That was a difficult one to figure out. Did you have any problems with it when you read it?
I put it this way, that the reason somebody like McLuhan is interesting to read is exactly why Aristotle is interesting to read, or Plato, and that is that they constantly say things that you don't understand.
Right.
And so if you want to be acute in your thinking, you have to be able to say in the face of a thinker that I don't know what's going on here. I'm a dumb guy.
Yeah.
And that's what's interesting. And so what I...
okay, so yeah, education is supposed to teach you something and then you know something. But the better educators make you feel stupid.
Correct. And feeling stupid is it can be a pleasure.
Yeah.
And it's certainly a guideline.
Right? What guideline did you say?
Guideline, yeah.
Guideline,
When somebody is a good thinker, and I think McLuhan was, then precisely when you don't understand something, there's something to be learned. It's like science. What could make somebody happier if you're a chemist, let's say, and you do you're doing some kind of experiment, and there's something about that experiment that doesn't make sense.
Yes.
That tells you that there's something there that's really important.
Yeah,
that's... And that when you make sense of that, you'll be able to make a contribution to the science. Well, it's just the same with McLuhan or with anybody good.
Yeah, they discovered with Darwin the missing link. What the hell? Yeah. How did this happen? You know, that was Darwin made everybody feel stupid. But the propagandists pretend they know what it means, and they want everybody to match with what they think the meaning of it is. No, it's just another
right.
question that they're coming up with. Okay, 2 points. Jung, McLuhan expresses interest. He's talking to Ong or somebody in the 40s, right? And he says, we gotta look into this Jung character. Now,
yeah.
one of the main competitions of Joyce is Jung, because the archetypes that Jung's dealing with are in the mind, in the interior landscape, and Joyce started to see the environments were archetypal or Jungian.
No, that's exactly what Jung is not about. I mean,
well, that's what I'm saying. Joyce came up with a different view.
But in Jung, the archetypes are what he calls collective. So they're necessarily beyond the individual.
Right, but they're still within the anthropomorphic sort of, or they're still within the human. We were talking about this a couple of talks ago about the ESP level, or where does a meme come from? So Jung is tapping into the meme aspects common to all cultures. Well, these memes get externalized as environments, and these environments are memic, but they're more archetypal because they come from our senses. And our senses are archetypal. So anyways, I saw... Now, Joyce doesn't fully spell that out. You have to read McLuhan and know that McLuhan is going beyond Jung, as he tries to show in From Cliché to Archetype. But he got the impetus to go past Jung from Joyce's attempt to go past Jung, or deeper than Jung. That's what I'm saying. And so... You're saying that Jung is very important, yes, but if he's important to McLuhan, he has to be toppled. I don't know, on behalf of Thomism or understanding, just understanding.
Yeah, so toppling is an interesting thing to think about. If you think about wrestling, let's say,
yeah,
if you're trying to topple your opponent, but the... toppling is embedded in an agon, a contest between the two sides. So reading somebody has to do with toppling them, but at the same time appreciating the dialogue that you're involved in with them. So Jung... is a rather surprising guy. He's a little bit like McLuhan in a way that he says a lot of things that are a little bit dumb or a little bit crude, you could say.
Yeah.
But he's got a lot of insights, a lot of sudden illuminations and stuff. And so it can be a happy experience reading Jung. And by the way, Jung was kind of taken forward by a guy by the name of James Hillman.
I know. And McClung quotes
okay.
him.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. He read his Hillman's early book,
yeah.
Emotion, and quotes that a lot.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he didn't. Oh, I guess McLuhan died before Hillman wrote Revisioning Psychology. But Revisioning Psychology is a great, great book. I'd recommend it to you if you haven't read it. I think it would go well with a lot of the thinking you do. He extricates psychology from human beings and talks about the reanimation of the world,
okay.
which is very, very important. I knew Hillman. He was a difficult guy.
How did you know him? You were a student of him?
It was like McLuhan again. I thought that it might be interesting to study with Hillman. Hillman, as you may know, went to the University of Dallas, which McLuhan went to later.
Yeah, in 75.
That's right. So Hillman wasn't there at the University of Dallas yet. But he would come in the early 80s. And I had read a lot of Jung and read a lot of Hillman, and I knew that he was in Dallas, so I went down and had a little bit of the same experience with Hillman that I already had with McLuhan. I was amazed at how Hillman was not open to ways in which I thought he should be open. And,
well, you were a man on a mission. You actually had some epiphanies you were trying to upgrade McLuhan and Hillman with.
Well, I generally when I thought there was something to be learned, I tried to go to the source.
Yeah.
And so Jung was already dead. Then I thought it would be interesting to study with Hillman, but that didn't work out any more than the idea of studying with McLuhan did.
Well, okay, so you encounter a guy who's closed-minded about your idea. Did he have other eccentricities, or was it just a conversation you had with him?
No, Hillman was well known to be extremely combative. an extremely difficult
an emotional person.
Well, I guess so. just a lot of people thought he was mean, or that he enjoyed hurting people, or something. I didn't know that. I didn't know him that well. I just met him a few times and had conversations with him and tried to judge if I would. Study with them, or maybe even undergo analysis. I had that thought at one point,
the problem is that there's just too much disagreement about basics or something that you're not going to get something out of them.
Yeah, just that with McLuhan, I just may have hit him at a bad time because of his operation and all
right.
that sort of stuff. With Hillman, I just thought that he didn't have the kind of elasticity to him that I thought was sort of basic to thought, and therefore that I wouldn't be able to get anything out of studying with him. I thought he would try to... I thought his idea of education was to impose on people his personality and his view. And to me, that was a contradiction to what he was writing, where the whole point is to appreciate exterior views in their independent animation.
Yeah. I was just thinking, I wonder if you're basically have a Canadian sensibility and you're encountering the kinetic bias, manipulatory bias, McLuhan says in page 136, Ecclesiate Archetype, the sensory bias of Americans, the manipulatory kinetic bias, is, and I don't know if that was in McLuhan, but as a Canadian, you're a different sensibility than this American guy.
Yeah, I think so. Canadians are allergic to imperialism.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
It doesn't matter if it's English or American
right.
or Chinese or whatever the hell it is. Now I'm a Western Canadian, and I can tell you that Western Canadians are getting sick and tired of Eastern Canadian imperialism.
Yes, yeah. And do you think McLuhan had the same bias as a Western Canadian? He was sick of Ontario imperialism. He pretended he did in that one interview with the CBC guy.
Yeah, McLuhan was a guy that he loved masks. He could put them on and take them off. So he didn't mind being a Winnipegian in some context. In other contexts, he liked being the guru from Toronto.
Right. So when I, in 76, I was with him and some Italian women came over and they wanted him to perform in a play. And I talked to them later, and they said they couldn't believe how bad of an actor he was. Now, this would be a univocal play, right? A visually framed play. I would say, and I've said it later, McLuhan was one of the greatest actors of our time. But he didn't operate just in a little square theater box. He operated in the global theater and created all these masks and roles and performances. It's right in that essay, Roles, Performances, and Masks, isn't it? Early 70s,
yeah.
that essay, and the voices of literature.
It's everywhere in his work.
And I would say that he was training people on the new desire requirement for people in the global theater to put on Quadrophenia, and he was showing you, like he said about Joyce, he could go into any culture and adopt its assumptions and put it on and work well with the culture.
Correct.
So he was a great actor that way.
Sure. And that's what he said was sort of the great lesson of modern anthropology, that modern anthropology was no longer sitting in a library somewhere in London reading about reports of missionaries and stuff. It was you got on a boat like Malinowski and you went to the Melanesian Islands and you lived there and you understood their phatic customs.
Right. Now, that's the other point. Another point I was going to bring up is that Jung is a product of anthropology and McLuhan is a product of a later science. He called it the student of media communications. That's where Joyce's archetypes go beyond anthropology and McLuhan does. And that's where Jung is limited to anthropology. I guess that's what I was trying to say.
I would say, if I would argue against that, I would say that Jung, like his colleague and mentor Freud, was able to do sort of individual anthropology. They were the great turn of modern psychology was to learn how to inhabit neuroses and psychoses and try to understand them from within.
Okay, so to enter the culture in the person's personality.
Correct.
Right, okay. Okay, but that's the individual. That's what he says in Cliche Archetype. That's Ulysses, the literate individual, say. Where Spinning His Wake deals with collectivities. Jung is in the interval between Freud doing personal exorcism and the collectivities of McLuhan. Jung's in between. He gets to the collective archetypes, but not the technical collective archetypes, which are the environment.
Maybe. I tend to see these things as sort of more complicated.
Being linear there?
Well, it's just that I have the same kind of respect for somebody like Jung that I have for McLuhan. I know that he's very, very complicated, and most of these people, we could spend a lifetime trying to sort of inhabit their thinking and to try to understand how much further they thought than we can. So, for example, if you think about Freud talks about civilization and its discontents. So this is far beyond individual psychology or dream interpretation,
yeah.
Right? And Jung was constantly talking about civilizations and fates, right? So I think you're going in a good direction with many of the things that you're saying. It's just that I'm not so sure that they can be said like that. I don't think we can use somebody like Jung as a marker and then say, well, he's in the middle between Freud and McLuhan. Pretty soon we're into sort of graduate student mode where we know how to set out all of Western civilization in terms of a bunch of names, right? instead of being able to actually think what any one of these names actually entail.
Okay, so on the parallel private citadel or citadel of consciousness, that's true.
Yeah.
But on the social manners, which one night a lady coming in to the Monday night seminar writing an update of Emily Post's manners, McLuhan pointed to her that's what he did. He studied manners. So he kind of, you know, we think of manners as kind of superficial, bourgeois activities or niceties or violations of it. And you don't think of media as manners. That's too superficial.
Yep. Well, no, I think you're absolutely right. McLuhan used the word decorum, right? Which
yes.
He got that from Maurice McNamee, who was writing a thesis on Bacon when McLuhan was writing his thesis in the early 1940s. So a lot of McLuhan's quote-unquote thinking in his thesis was just transcriptions of McNamee talking about Bacon.
Right.
Right. And one of the ways that McNamee talked about Bacon was in terms of decorum. And then so in the at the end of the 1940s, McLuhan has his essay on Eliot and what Eliot's historical decorum, I think
yes,
it's called.
Yes.
And that's that essay is very, very important.
Right. Now,
McLuhan.
But when he said that, so he reduces media study to manners, that's the citadel of consciousness that's not affected by media speaking. He's on that side, and media are silly, trivial. Now, they're just arguing over manners, and then new media
manners are not something trivial and stupid.
I was taking it that way. It seems odd that he reduced his work to, updating Emily Post.
But I don't think he was reducing it. I think that's related to a whole bunch of things that we've talked about. I mean, when McLuhan is relating to his children, especially when the children are really young, what he's trying to communicate with them is manners, is etiquette, is a certain way of relating to the environment.
Yeah.
And the difficulty he has is that he is not sure himself how to go about it, both as his way of being and as his way of teaching.
Yeah.
Okay? So the whole question of manners and etiquette, that's just another way of saying, how do I inhabit an environment?
Right. Now, he says to Michael Horniansky in 76, one of the rare times he defines his Menippean satire, he says, presenting a ludicrous image of the surface manners of society or of life.
Right.
That's where he indicates manners as surface. I know the lady was shocked that she was being told that McLuhan was in the same field, you know?
Uh-huh.
She didn't believe that. But yeah, he was given the ground manners, the ground gestures to her surface gestures, her fashionable concerns about, you know, how people set their table in the 70s as opposed to the 60s, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, but that's significant. Now, I want to add something. Jung, an example of the disgusting state of the McLuhan industry, and I don't know if this guy was a McLuhanite, but it was said to another McLuhanite, someone who promotes McLuhanisms, he was shocked when he looked at my essay, and I don't know how much he read of it. How could I put McLuhan and Trump in the same sentence? Obviously despicable, Trump is a scumbag, and McLuhan was, you know, a high priest of wonderfulness. I never thought, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, that you can't put the thinker in the same sentence as what's thought about. You see how crazy that is? How could I discuss Trump in the same paragraph with McLuhan? I wasn't saying Trump was equal to McLuhan. I was using McLuhan to explain Trump.
Yeah.
That's the most recent intellectual stupidity I've ever heard in a long time. I mean, ridiculous. When I was told this, I and the person that was told this said, yeah, it beats me why Bob does that. So I swore at him. Call him a fucking idiot. That was my response to him, to even engage and not, you know, chastise the idiot who said that. Can you believe it? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the person was not making an intellectual point. It was just like saying, how can you mention these two in the same breath?
Well, right? Maybe he's a high culture literate snob, and he doesn't understand the cognitive school that you look at popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
So he was the ethical, cathartic, you know, Matthew Arnold school. Which quote I begin with in my essay. I quote McLuhan talking about the two views, the ethical view of art, and the which is cathartic, and the cognitive view.
That's how actually we started our conversation today. Maybe what we should do is we're coming up now to, I think we're almost at 3 hours. we're almost at 3 hours. So what we might do is stop for this week.
Okay.
At the point that...
at the beginning of my book.
Initially, that's right. And so what we could do is take up, next time we can take up the very same starting point, but attempt to make a different kind of progress.
Now, there's the cul-de-sac. We are manifesting.
That's right.
Yeah. Every That's conversation correct. Is, we're in the cul-de-sac once again.
That's it. That
you know,
it.
A guy I knew in New York, Harold Chandler, he when McLuhan came out of his, you know, long surgery in 67, he said he had these songs going on in his head. And it was some famous guy, Harry somebody of the 30s.
Yeah, probably Harry Lauder.
I think that's who it was, yes. So Harold Chandler, out of the blue, I've known him in New York for many years, he started singing a Harry Lauder song. And I said, that was McLuhan's core melody or core rhythmic conditioning. And the song he sang was, well, we're on our way. No, sorry. It goes, what is it? We're on our way. Yeah, well, we don't know where we're going. We don't know where we're going, but we're well on our way. That's the cul-de-sac.
We're going somewhere.
We're well on our way going somewhere, but don't know where we're going. Okay, so when I attempt to be linear and start creating a direction, I'm aware that it's going to break down pretty quickly.
Right.
I remain in the cul-de-sac. So I leave you with this. What the heck did McLuhan mean in Understanding Media when he said edible spaceships? We're going to have soon edible spaceships.
Yeah, good question.
Spaceships as a means of ejecting, you know, out of the cul-de-sac. And they're edible.
Yeah. So I don't want to talk at great length here, but the satellite takes the Earth with it, right? And so in a certain sense, the satellite has to be edible. Just like the Earth is the source of everything edible, so the new Earth of a satellite needs to be the source of everything edible, or actually be edible.
All right. The other meaning is it's a psychedelic mushroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in
the inner trip,
external.
You took the outer trip route. I was implying the inner trip route. Anyway, so that, I mean, I pretended rhetorically, I didn't know what it meant, but that's, I take it as an inner trip. But your way of saying that you're consuming the previous environment, you're eating the previous environment, is that what you're saying?
Well, no, there is that sense, but the sense I was talking about is that you, the way any environment is inhabited is that environment is edible in a whole series of different ways. So with the satellite, with the exploration of outer space, the environments that are created by humans need to be edible in an analogous way to the way that the old physical environment was. And so there, what I would take McLuhan to be talking about is not spaceships going out from the Earth or drugs going into the interior environment, but the new consciousness that is possible of environments plural, and what we can learn about being human beings derived from that plurality.
Right. And what was I going to say? In his Burroughs article, he quotes Joyce's Stephen Hero. I think it's in that book, where the common thing among humans between a Chinese person and other cultures and races is the digestive system. Now, there's a lot of food eating in Finnegan's Wake, and that's a metaphor of media eating each other. And I think of that, that's the archetype. The digestive system is the basic process, and we have grown new stomachs. Not just the chemical body stomach, but the digital stomach, the TV stomach. That's a thought that occurs to me based on what you were saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, we could talk about that for a long time because the digestive system, as you suggest, is not singular but plural.
Yeah.
And that gets us exactly into where we started this conversation, because it suggests an infinite regress, right? If we always wear a mask, if we always have a certain digestive system, then any attempt to sort of have a definitive mask or to have the definitive stomach is always going to fail, because in order to assess masks, you need a mask. In order to digest everything, you need a stomach, right? Which needs to be digested in turn, right? And so we've come full circle back to the sorts of questions that are raised by the very start of your book.
Right, and it seems to me resonates with the modern dilemma of what to do with masks today. Should we wear them or not? Do they protect
you? Absolutely. That's, I didn't think of that connotation, but it's absolutely right.
It fits. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that's a good point to end on, since it's my point,
sir.
Right?
Yeah.
You had last week's point.
No, that was a good one. That was a good one.
Yeah, I just hope it got all recorded.
Game to Mr. Dobbs.
What'd you say?
Game to Mr.
Dobbs.
Oh,
yeah, yeah. That's right. So look up that Harry Lauder song. We don't know where we're going, but we're well on our way.
Absolutely.
Okay.
My grandparents were both born in Scotland, and so they were great fans of Harry Lauder.
Oh, he was a Scottish singer?
Yes.
So how come Americans heard him?
Well,
in the 30s.
They may not have. Was this an American or was this?
Yeah, Harold Channer's an American, true American.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. I've seen him. I've seen your interview
with
him.
Yes. He's a McLuhanite.
So
he's an interesting McLuhanite.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know where exactly Harry Lauder was a singer. He may have been in the United States. I think he was originally from Scotland, but I don't know if he came across and became a
probably
you know, a person in New York. But we can look that up.
Yes, we have wonderful environments around us, surrounding us.
That's right.
That's give us an ESP immediately.
There you go.
Okay, let's hope this is recorded. So you hang up, and I'll bring it home.
All right, Bob, thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Cameron. It was great talk.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.